Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the beautiful Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Today we have the second of our segment on the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus.
Then Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Amy Halloran speaks with baker Dawn Woodward of Evelyn Crackers in Troy about regional grain economies, grain terroir, and true artisan production.
And later on, for the Peace Bucket, we interview Maureen Amand about an upcoming event with Kathy Kelly.
Then we're going to have a segment from Dave Pablo about farming.
And finally, we hear from Joe Lombardo about a rally to protest the U.S. efforts to engineer a coup in Venezuela. But first, headlines.
Pressure is mounting on New York City Congressmember Jerry Nadler, head of the House Judiciary Committee, to begin impeachment proceedings against President Trump. The party's leadership, however, wants to give special counsel Robert Mueller time to complete his two-year investigation into possible collusion between Russia and Trump in the 2016 presidential election. Assemblymember Joanne Simon of Brooklyn has proposed a state ban on using guns as a prize for games of chance. The potential restrictions would affect a wide range of nonprofit groups, including fire departments, Boy Scout troops, and fraternal organizations. Nonprofits are currently only banned from offering alcoholic beverages for winning a game of chance, according to the state's general municipal law. Also on Tuesday, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders announced that he will once again seek the Democratic Party's nomination to run for president, joining an increasingly crowded field. Sanders said, "Our campaign is about transforming our country and creating a government based on the principles of economic, social, racial, and environmental justice."
Russian President Vladimir Putin said his country would not seek nuclear confrontation with the U.S. and would not take the first step in deploying missiles after the suspension of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, the INF Treaty. However, he said Russia would respond to any deployment of new intermediate-range missiles in Europe by targeting the United States itself and not just the countries where they held. The U.S. has suspended its participation in the decades-old IMF treaty, which bans ground-launched medium-range missiles with a range of 310 to 3,400 miles. The U.S. administration said it had taken measures following Russia's refusal to accept that its SSC-8 missile directly contravenes the Cold War era agreement. The next day, Putin reacted by also halting his country's obligations to the treaty.
An upstate New York man who recently died of lung cancer has a simple message in his obituary. If you're a smoker, quit now. The Times Union of Albany reports 66-year-old Jeff Turner wanted to warn others not to make his mistake in a self-written obituary published Saturday. Turner said he was an idiot who made the same stupid decision day after day. He said, "Remember, life is good. Don't let it go up in smoke." For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
So up first is the second part of a series of interviews I did with legislators and activists at the annual Black and Puerto Rican Caucus. In our second part of covering the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus Conference on February 16th. We talked to Jerome Brown about the issue of marijuana legalization. We talked to Amy Cohen of Families for Safe Streets and Jim Anderson, the state co-chair of Citizen Action. So we're at the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, and Jerome Brown has a little sticker on, "We Rise to Legalize." So what are some of your
issues with respect to the proposals about legalization of marijuana?
I have no issues with the proposals for the legalization of marijuana. Our issue is we want some of that revenue coming back to the communities hardest hit by the illegalization of marijuana. So we have six pillars that we're standing on. We want investment in our community. We want job opportunities. We want expansion for medical marijuana, because currently elderly people who have prescriptions for medical marijuana have to go way out. They have to travel miles to get it. So we want them to put, we want them to have something in our community where they can go fill their prescription. We also want expungements, which means if you're about to legalize marijuana, people shouldn't be penalized. They should be able to get their record expunged for minor marijuana infractions, and then they'll be able to go apply for a job without that popping on their record. Also, we want a sustainable workforce. We want opportunities for minority women and black enterprises to be able to get into the workforce with the legalization of marijuana. Currently, they have one in Pittsfield. But if you go around to any of the dispensaries, you don't see too many people of our color at these dispensaries. And also, we want education for the community, not just on marijuana. And with saying that, we also want education on the abuse program. We want some of the funding to go towards the abuse program, because some people do abuse marijuana.
So individuals who have previously been convicted of, say, marijuana sales or distribution, should they be given any type of priority in terms of getting licenses to sell?
Well, that's actually something that they are doing in California right now. They are giving people who have been penalized by this, they're giving them opportunities to be able to restructure their lives and be able to lawfully sell marijuana now.
And if people want to find out more information about your positions and groups, is there a website?
Yeah, all they got to go to Twitter, to Instagram, or to Facebook, and you go to We Rise to Legalize.
Thank you very much. So we're talking with Amy Cohens, who's here with Transportation Alternatives, and particularly Families for Safe Streets. Can you explain to our listeners a little bit of what is the Safe Streets project or position?
So Families for Safe Streets is a group no one should ever have to join. We all lost a family member, suffered a serious injury in a traffic crash. I lost my son 5 years ago. He was nearly 13 years old, and he was struck and killed by a speeding driver in front of our home. No one should ever have to bury their child, and yet it's happening almost every day. It's a national epidemic. It's happening in New York City. It's happening everywhere in New York State. You know, we're one of the most dangerous countries in terms of traffic crashes. Other places have started to solve this problem. We're doing some amazing things in New York City. 30% fewer people are killed in traffic crashes since our group was formed 5 years ago. But still, someone is killed in New York City nearly every day, and the numbers are the same around the state. We have solutions out there, and we just need the political will to use them. Right now, we're here in Albany fighting for speed safety cameras in front of New York City schools to protect every New York City school student, to protect all New Yorkers. No one should be killed because they're walking, biking, being a passenger, a car, driving a car. This epidemic has to stop.
So what are some of the other solutions that could be taken to try to reduce you know, pedestrian fatalities by being hit by transportation cars?
Yeah, I mean, the most dangerous streets in almost every community are known. In New York City, there was one called Queens Boulevard. People called it the Boulevard of Death. How could you jokingly know you had such a problem that was so dangerous you called it the Boulevard of Death? When we know that if you redesign your streets for safety in mind, it's transformative. So we took on transforming the Boulevard of Death into the Boulevard of Life. We pushed for 3 years to redesign that street, and since then, no one has died on Queens Boulevard in New York City. We have these solutions. You redesign your streets, you have speed cameras, you lower the speed limit, you identify the most dangerous drivers and re-educate them, and you hold people accountable after a crash. Those things work. We need them all, and we need them all now.
I know that the de Blasio administration has articulated the goal of working on this issue. You know, how would you rate the city's performance so far in recent years?
So the framework of saving lives is called Vision Zero, It's using data to find the most dangerous places and the solutions that work and putting those in place so that we have zero traffic fatalities. And actually, it's not perfect, but it is working. As I said, traffic fatalities are down 30% in New York City, when in recent years, they're up 15% across the country. So what we're doing is working. We just need more of it, and we need it faster.
And if people want to find out more about Families for Safe Streets, they have a website, Facebook page that they can look at?
Yep, website, Facebook page. In addition to Fighting for Change, we support anybody, everybody who's been through a traffic crash, whether you lost someone or you were injured. No one should have to walk this road alone.
And the name of the webpage? Yeah.
FamiliesForSafeStreets.org.
Thank you very much, Amy. So next we catch up with Jim Anderson, who is the Vice President of Citizen Action of New York. He hails from Buffalo. Jim, what brings you to the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus Conference today?
Well, there are several discussions that will be going on up here that we need to be involved in. One, of course, is fair elections and the impact of what unfair elections are doing, as well as the concern about how we develop an upstate and downstate homeless alliance that really works. You know, a lot of times things are looked at as New York City, and the particulars for upstate are quite different, so we need to make sure we have a real balance in order to move a state legislature towards the right direction. I also think it's interesting to look into, as people continue to talk about the legalization of marijuana and how good it is for communities of color, is to be sure that the stuff they talk about on the front end about the value incentives for those communities are in whatever legislation is finally produced. And also here, since the meetings are going to be providing a lot of discussion in all these issues, particularly around the inequities, the runaway inequality that is affecting everybody, but particularly communities on the front line, just like with climate, with economics, with healthcare, with education. There needs to be deep discussion, and people need to really understand so they can go back and organize their communities. It's good to see a lot of people turn out, but, you know, sometimes these events can be like folks going to a parade and to watch and see and ooh and ah, but this is serious business, and the accountability after this day will see what people have taken back to their communities.
Now, on the homeless issue, I know for a couple of years, I think we assembly in my Hevesy, had been pushing for some type of, additional rent payments to try to deal with the homeless issues. What are some of the things, you know, particularly as an upstate resident, you think the state should be doing to help address the homeless issue?
I think that, you know, when we got a lot of veterans all around the state, and upstate we have a lot of veterans. Often when we look at veterans, there's not a lot of inclusion of veterans of color. I mean, most of the homeless housing situation around vets up in my area are operated by majority, not by people of color. And the real opportunities within, deeper in the communities, to establish entities that could house veterans need to be developed. I think also a special initiative to help veterans who are after the most immediate wars we end really find their footing. It, you know, that whole issue has been kind of washed over by the false patriotism. And so when people say, thank you for your service, they need to think about, yeah, well, are they really thankful? When you look at the impediments that still exist for so many vets, it's a front-end promise, and it's a good soundbite for young vets who are, like, hyped up, oh, I'm going in the military, but haven't hit the reality of the deficits that it provides. To give you a clear example, look at the national issue going on with Army housing right now in the dilapidated housing and those I should say, greedy investors who want to call itself developing on behalf of veterans that don't really serve what veterans need.
So we've been talking with Jim Anderson, Vice President of Citizen Action. Jim, website?
Yes, citizenactionny.org.
This is Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was part two of Mark's segments from the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus. The first segment, along with many other stories, is posted on our website and podcasts. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Amy Halloran speaks with baker Dawn Woodward of Evelyn's Crackers in Toronto about regional grain economies, grain terroir, and true artisan production.
Hi, I'm Amy Halloran, and you're here for another Food Diary. We are talking today on our Women in Grain segment with Dawn Woodward from Evelyn's Crackers in Toronto. Dawn, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Amy. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. So let's tell our listeners a little bit about your business and your growth in regional grains.
Sure. So we started about 10 years ago. The business is primarily myself and my husband, also my business partner, Ed. And we started making crackers with local or Ontario grains and in the whole grain form. And since then, we have expanded into breads and other baked goods. And then on a more personal level, I've sort of become a whole grain, local grain advocate and have done workshops in the States and taught at conferences and even got to travel to England last year to talk about my philosophy on why local grains are so important.
And why are local grains so important?
So there's a couple of reasons. From just a straight up chef perspective, I also have a cooking background. I just think the flavor of grains really have an amazing capacity to express terroir, especially when they're used in the whole grain form because the flavor is in the bran and the endosperm. Grains can have really distinctive flavors from area to area. Plus, when you're working with smaller farmers, they have a better ability to grow different varieties and multiple varieties, and then you're working with smaller organic farmers. A lot of them have a huge interest in heirloom varieties, and just like heirloom veggies, a lot of heirloom grains have really superior flavor. And then from a political perspective, I think local food is what gives us autonomy and gives us diversity and is environmentally sustainable, right? We need to preserve farmland. We need to support farmers. We need to be able to make food choices and not be at the mercy of these huge agricultural businesses that just want to feed us bland commodity crops that are destroying the environment. So there's many reasons to support local grains, but I think that one of the easiest access points is just straight up flavor.
Yes, it starts with flavor, and then it has this whole cascading effect back to the ground. Can you talk a little bit? I think most people have a hard time understanding what we mean when we say that when we talk about the commodity grain system and the limited choices that creates both for growers and then for chefs and bakers and everyone along the way.
Sure. So when you ask people about local food, you know, they can name all sorts of items that they can buy locally. And I would bet you $1 million that wheat is never on that list. It has been so centralized and commoditized and mistreated that it's turned into a bag of dead white stuff that's on every shelf in every market. And nobody has any idea where it came from, how it was processed, who grew it. Right? It's just weird. So when you put the local back into it, suddenly you're talking about, you have a sense of place, a sense of history. Suddenly wheat takes on all kinds of dimensions, and it has flavor when it's used in its whole grain form, or even a higher extraction, right? When it's run through the stone mill and lightly sifted, it comes alive. It becomes food instead of just this weird white stuff that we make sweet things with or bad bread with.
Right. And you can populate that as a baker with literal people doing the milling and doing the growing all the way back to the field. So that's the difference that I see between a commodity, homogenous, undertaking, and then things that are really individualized. So
yep.
It's a little bit easier, or a lot easier, really, in using a heritage grain, right, to get
right.
some kind of identity going. Can you talk about the
yep.
relationships that you have with the growers and the grains?
Sure. So right now I'm working primarily with two growers. One is this woman, Shelley Spruitt, of Against the Grain Farms, and she is primarily focused on regional grains, different kinds of barley, some interesting wheats, and corn. And then the other grower I work with is Peter Leahy of Maryland Organics, and he grows primarily wheat with rye and buckwheat. So I think my relationship with these two people is extremely important. One, they're both farmers who have a keen interest in growing different varieties and want to work directly with the end user of the product. So they want feedback. They want to grow different things. So to be able to work together and be like, well, yeah, let's try this. And where can we find seed? And, you know, doing little test bakes for them and getting feedback. It's really important. It just gives a huge sense of place and makes me feel connected to the food system.
Right, because when you were baking with products from a larger food system, you certainly never would have seen a grower or even a miller.
No, not at all. It was just coming in the back of a huge truck, right, being unloaded by the pallet.
Right. And in baking, you know, it's I was surprised as I researched my book and people would say chagrined, bakers would say with a big bit of shame, I never thought about my main ingredient beyond the bag. And that's not their fault. But a lot of attention is given to the craft and the methods. And it's only recently that we're beginning to look backwards to the craft and the methods that go into the grain production and the milling itself.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, but I've always felt that if you want to call something artisan, to me, that extends all the way down to the ingredients. So if you're making your bread with commodity, non-organic, roller milled white flour, I don't consider your product artisan. You know, I really draw a line in the sand at that.
Right.
You know, regardless of your technique and your background, you know, technique is great. But at this point, I think food is so political. The earth is in crisis. We need to be conscientious of how we're practicing our business on every level. And just to be focused on technique and mastery of something is, I find, sort of a conceited and very limiting notion if we're not part of the bigger picture.
Right. And you can really make an impact. In your sales of food, what kind of dialogues do you have with your customers about the sourcing?
All kinds. People, been at a farmer's market, people really come with a lot of their food fears. And because they know it's a slightly alternative place to shop and you are right there behind the table for them to either engage with or they can accost you. You get all kinds. But people just have a lot of questions, but a lot of it is based on fear and lack of information. And I'm really happy to engage, but part of me finds it kind of sad that we've somehow reached this state where people are afraid to put food in their mouths.
Right. And especially when there's so many more important conversations you could be having
yes.
in your brief moments together.
Yes. Yes. It's really focused on individual diets and what they should be avoiding. And I had this conversation earlier today, actually, with somebody about people are still asking about GMO grain. And I mean, I'm absolutely against GMOs because of seed patenting and corporate ownership. But, you know, there is no GMO grain on the market.
Right.
Right. You can't. And plus, my grains are certified organic. And I do advertise that. And people still ask if they're GMO. So it just shows that there's just a really big disconnect. I also have really fruitful conversations with, you know, other customers who don't have so many dietary issues and can engage more about local or more about on a flavor perspective of like why rye versus buckwheat or why am I not just using regular wheat? You know, so it does run the gamut.
So check out Evelyn's Crackers on Instagram for more info on that and to get mouthwateringly hungry by just looking at the beautiful creations that Dawn makes. Dawn, thank you so much for joining me. I'm really happy to hear some more about your work.
Oh, thanks, Amy. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I can't wait to hear the podcast on all the podcasts and everyone you interview.
Awesome. Thanks, Dawn.
All right. Oh, thanks. All right.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for tuning in. This has been another Women in Grains Food Diary with Amy Halloran, Food Security Case Manager at Unity House.
And so as she noted, that was Amy Halloran, another food diary, and she was speaking with Dawn Woodward of Evelyn's Crackers.
And for those running to the windows to see if it's sleeting yet, I'm J.P. Pogorski.
And I'm Art Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to feed to our mascot, Herschel, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
We're joined now, actually, by Marina Mann, but Kathy Kelly of the Voices for Creative Nonviolence is doing a series of events with Women Against War and others in the Capital District from February 28th to March 3rd. Maureen is coordinating Kathy's visit. Good evening, Maureen.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
We're fine. So why don't we start off a little bit about who is Kathy Kelly, and then also understand there's a second person who's doing a lot of the speaking with her?
Yes. Kathy's going to be joined by Hoor Arifi, who is a student currently at Bennington College on scholarship, who was part of the Afghan peace volunteer youth group that Kathy has been speaking about and working with for quite a few years now in Afghanistan. And he got the possibility of coming to study in the United States, so we thought it would be a great opportunity for her to speak with him about something that's very vital in her activism right now and has been for, as I said, for a number of years. Kathy Kelly is a internationally recognized peace activist who's been working for almost the last four decades on issues of war. And basically, as her witness has evolved, she's felt that what she was called to do was to go to war-torn countries in order to be able to firsthand experience what the victims of war experience, and then be able to come back home and keep that fresh in all of our minds so that we who pay for these wars and perhaps don't effectively enough lobby against them can really be kind of inspired by a closer realization of what the impact is. So Kathy has been to Iraq numbers of times since the beginning of the first Persian Gulf War, and then through second Gulf War Iraq invasion. In fact, she was there in Baghdad during Shock and Awe. She decided she would be there so she could speak to it directly. She has been going to Afghanistan quite frequently in the last decade and working with this young group of people who coalesced around the idea that even though they came from different ethnic backgrounds within the country, that they wanted to figure out how they could live together peacefully. So model that kind of peaceful coexistence, kind of with the notion of building peaceful civil society, and also how to help their neighbors directly being impacted economically by the war. So she provides a lot of support for them, and I think probably a lot of inspiration. So Iraq and Afghanistan are high in Kathy's travels and witness. And also, she's a war tax resister. She's been that most of her adult life. She's a anti-nuke resister. She's been to prison over 60 times, jail or prison for her witness, her activism. She once spent 9 months in a federal prison for planting corn on a missile site. She's written, she's an author, she writes often short form and has written about her prison experiences and about her anti-war activism. So, Kathy, I think it would be fair to say by the total commitment of her work serves as kind of an inspiration, I think, for anti-war people wherever she travels and, you know, wherever she's read.
Okay.
So that's a thumbnail of Kathy.
Could you tell us who is sponsoring Kathy Kelly's visit to the Capital Region?
Well, Women Against War, we often try to reach out to as many groups and entities in the area that kind of form a partnership and coalition with. So we are sponsoring and organizing Kathy's tour, but she's speaking at a number of venue, and in each case, you know, we're working in coalition with those who agreed that it would be a great idea to have her come. So Kathy and Hoor, I'd be glad to go through the schedule and give you a kind of a sense of who we're working with.
Well, our listeners probably can go to a website that you can offer us, and they can look at the events listed there. Meantime, could you tell us maybe a little bit more about Women Against War?
Yes, Women Against War is a grassroots network of area women who, before the Second Gulf War, the war in Iraq, I almost feel like it was the most organic kind of coming together, came together in a kind of common angst about the war, hoping that we could, like so many other people, find ways of speaking to the untenability of that intended war. And so Women Against War formed at that period, and we continue to work together in coalition. And what we try to do is look at, I guess, disaggregate the causes of war, the direction that U.S. military and militarism, imperatives seem to be taking, so that we can study and both learn and understand as much as we can the geopolitics that kind of underpin the kind of the militarism that guides us as a nation so often in our foreign policy, and to try to speak to an alternative to that. So we try to learn for ourselves, provide opportunities for other people to learn, provide opportunities for other people to come together around issues of war and peace and foreign policy. We do that through events like this, bringing speakers who are inspiring and bring us on-the-ground information, through lobbying, through research, through writing. Women Against War has a blog in the Times Union that is very well read, in fact, is read internationally. And so that's an ongoing effort. Women Against War works in project teams that, again, form organically around the current issues. And the project team that's bringing Kathy specifically has gone through a number of evolutions, including looking at the war in Iraq, then looking at the war in Afghanistan, and then looking at the issue of drones, which is something that Kathy is looking at. And then out of that, kind of looking at the issue of endless war and how to build pathways to peace. So it's a very organic organization. And we're working in conjunction for Kathy's visit with the Iran Project Committee, which again, you know, is trying to focus attention on what looks like a next target on the radar of the militarist who would drive foreign policy.
So we're talking with Maureen Amann about Kathy Kelly's upcoming visit from Thursday, February 28th to Sunday, March 3rd. You know, one of the topics certainly on the schedule is Afghanistan. You know, President Trump has, you know, said recently that he wants to pull all American troops out of Afghanistan, or at least, you know, a significant portion of them. I'm curious whether, you know, does Kathy have a particular position at this point as to what the U.S. should do, both in general in Afghanistan and particularly whether it's beyond time to remove troops?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should ask because I was just looking at a piece that she's submitting to the Times Union for an op-ed, you know, to kind of precede her being here. And I think that her answer to that would be that she thinks it's definitely past time. I think, you know, the people she speaks with feel that not only does continued American presence embolden and the Taliban and also gain constant recruit for the Taliban, they also feel that, you know, in terms of the damage done, the disruption, the loss of life, the horror, the fabric of life that's so interrupted, that basically there's no good that is coming out of this. So she would, I think, support the withdrawal of troops. But she also argues, I think, quite passionately that we owe reparation. I haven't heard a lot of discussion around that, but she feels that the damage done has to be compensated for in some way, and also that becomes foundational for moving forward, for the country to move forward in a more peaceful way. It would fill in some of those holes that might lend themselves to, you know, kind of going backward.
We have about 3 minutes left. What are, you know, I see on her schedule at least looks like at least five visits. What are some of the highlights of her visit? Where is her the website for the whole schedule?
Okay, the best place to look would be the Women Against War Facebook page. So Women Against War event. Look for Women Against War on Facebook, and under events, her whole schedule will be there. I'll also, if I can, I'll give my email address and people can check in with me. Three highlights that I'd like to make that are open to the public. On Thursday evening at the Unitarian Church on Washington Avenue, Kathy's going to be giving a public talk. The topic is, along with Hoor Arifi, and war costs. And we're asking her to speak to not only the human costs, which she does so passionately, but also the implications for our own economic situation. You know, what are the costs? What are the drivers that allow us to keep moving in this direction? And that's going to be moderated by a woman by the name of Christina Charles, who actually is the organizer of the last two women's marches in the area. We reached out to her. Because she has a different, comes from a different perspective, and we wanted to bring that perspective of how do citizens who aren't normally involved with anti-war work,
what
do they
want
to hear? Okay, and then Friday evening at the Sisters of Mercy Mother House, she's going to be speaking at their monthly prayer group on the topic of witness to the human cost of war, the imperative to work for peace. And on Saturday, a very interesting thing at Friends Meeting, Caring About Yemen. It's going to be a gathering that will be inspired by an event that happened in New York City last year, a theatrical event called Imagine Yemen, where a number of playwrights wrote pieces to highlight the nature of the conflict in Yemen. And we're using some of those pieces. We're working with a theater artist. And Kathy herself will be playing a part, and those will infuse and inspire conversation about what we can do about Yemen, what we need to know about Yemen. So those are three public events. There's quite a few others that the public is invited to that are being held in both at Union College and at the Islamic Center in Schenectady on Sunday, and they are community-based, but certainly open to the public. So I do urge people to take a look at our Facebook page and to consider. And my email address is AUMANDMAUREEN@gmail.com.
Okay. Thank you, Maureen, for joining us and talking about Kathy Kelly's visit to the Capital Region coming up between February 28th and March 3rd, a number of visits. Thank you again, Maureen.
Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity.
Kathy Kelly, a long-term peace activist and co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
So, JP, what's our next segment?
Our next segment.
Next segment. We're going to go do a little bit with Dave on the farm situation.
Okay. The Northeast Organic Farming Association's annual winter conference is both a learning opportunity for farmers and a business opportunity for small businesses, as our farm correspondent recently confirmed.
So this is Dave Pablo, and I am still at the 2019 NOFA New York conference right now. As you might be able to hear, there's a lot of activity in the background, although way less than there was before, because I'm out in the vendor area, and I'm speaking to one of the vendors. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Carol Michaelfelder, and I'm here with my company, Taproot Threads.
Tell me what you guys do, and what's your angle on this market?
Sure. So I started this company, if I'm doing my math correctly, about 6 years ago. And what we do is we hand-draw our original botanical and homesteading PUD designs and silkscreen them on either USA-made or certified fair trade clothing, and we travel all over the country and sell it.
We talked about this a little bit yesterday, probably, about all the different fairs that you go to. What, I mean, obviously this one is very agricultural oriented. Are there others that have a different bent?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that we found works really well for us are actually herbal conferences. So similar format to this NOFA conference, although mostly about herbalism. Most of them are women only, and a lot of the plants that I draw are actually medicinal herbs. I am by no means an herbalist, but I know a little bit and I dabble, and I really love the idea that perhaps if you're wearing the medicinal herb, you might get a little bit of an effect from it as well. So we do a lot of herbal conferences. We also do Mother Earth News Fairs, which are sort of similar to NOFA, only on a much larger scale.
So starting a small business is a very difficult prospect. I've done that in the past, and I'm wondering, did you fall into your pattern of going to different conferences and things like that, or how did this evolve?
We absolutely fell into a pattern of going to different conferences. We actually started out just at our local farmers markets. We're in Western Massachusetts, specifically in Greenfield. And actually, I ended up leaving my job in December of 2012 and basically took the winter and taught myself how to screen print and kind of got things up and running. And in that time, my mom suggested that I maybe take some courses at the community college, so I wasn't alone all the time. She thought it might get weird. So I actually ended up taking a permaculture course at Greenfield Community College, and that is actually how I found out about NOFA. So once I kind of got my business off the ground, I called up the person who was at that point in charge of the NOFA Summer Conference and said, hey, this is what I'm trying to do. You know, does it sound like it would be a good fit? And that was actually the NOFA Summer Conference of 2013 was our first big show, and it was really successful. So we've been a part of NOFA ever since.
What made you choose screen printing?
I actually started out, I was hand-painting t-shirts and tote bags, which was really fun, but, you know, it would take 6-7 hours to create a t-shirt, and there was no way to actually make a living from that, so it was suggested to me that I might try screen printing, and I was given a sort of basic screen printing kit for my 30th birthday, and it sat in the attic for a couple years until I finally decided to do something with it, so.
I'm also a printmaker, and that process I found to be very freeing because, yes, you're right, you can't hand paint a t-shirt and try and sell it for $500, breaking down the number of hours you put into it. Have you tried other forms of printmaking or just screen printing at this point?
I did actually major in art in college, and I took a printmaking course, so I did some lino cuts and block printing and that sort of thing. Etching, I think I really like.
We'd also talked a little bit about your business going forward, and I guess what I'm wondering with this one is, again, as a small business person, it's difficult to start up, but it's also difficult to either adhere to a vision or to adapt to changing markets. And so where do you see things going for you?
Yeah, that's actually very current to what we're trying to figure out with our business model right now. We're finding now that we've been, I think this is coming into our 7th summer in a couple of months, and we've probably oversaturated some of the markets that we've done, so we're looking at some different stuff. But we also our daughter was born 18 months ago, and we're finding traveling with a little one to be pretty difficult. So we're branching out into doing doing some custom designs. We actually did the t-shirt for NOFA, the NOFA New York Winter Conference this year and last year. We've done some other custom work, and we're really looking to increase our online presence. We're working on our own website. We've been selling on Etsy for 6 years, but we're trying to beef that up. Just figure out how we can continue to have income coming in without leaving home so much.
Tell me what your take is on Etsy.
I think that Etsy is a really great way to start selling online, because Etsy takes care of all of the security. You can, you know, push a button and it'll print a shipping label with exactly the address that your customer entered, so there's no question about that. I think there are so many people selling on Etsy, it's really easy to get lost. So I find that most of my Etsy customers are folks that I've met at shows, handed them a business card with our direct Etsy shop link. Because unless somebody is really specifically looking for, say, mason jar t-shirts, you know, it's not, your product isn't really just going to come up unless you've been selling on Etsy for a long time and have many, many, many sales.
That's actually a common theme, not the Etsy thing, but the personal connection, either, you know, direct physical presence or some people were talking about social media, but like there's a farmer, I went to his presentation yesterday, and he thinks that a lot of his success was due to social media interactions and direct person-to-person types of connections.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. And while I'm by no means an expert on social media, I have been working really hard to keep us current on both Facebook and especially Instagram. And we've started to use both sites are now offering that you can pay a little bit to promote a certain post. And so when I, for example, update my Etsy site or come out with a new design or something like that, I will promote it. And I've very much seen direct correspondence to that. You know, like I'll promote a post where I've updated my Etsy site and our sales will double, triple, quadruple over the next few weeks. So yeah, that's if, and I really want to learn more. I'm thinking about taking a social media marketing course this winter because I think it is very effective.
So speaking of which, if our listeners want to check out your products online and maybe get in touch with you, how would they go about doing that?
Absolutely. So our Facebook and Instagram are both Taproot Threads, all one word, and our direct Etsy site is www.taprootthreads.etsy.com.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that was our correspondent, Dave Pablo, speaking with Carol Mitchelfelder about her screen printing business, Taproot Threads, at the 2019 Northeast Organic Farm Association Winter/New York Winter Conference. So up next, we're joined now by Joe Lombardo, a vigil and demonstration against United States intervention in Venezuela will take place this Saturday, February 23rd at noon at Wolf Road and Central Avenue. February 23rd has been designated as a global day of protest against U.S. intervention in Venezuela. Back with us is Joe Lombardo, who's a co-founder of Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace and co-chair of the United National Anti-War Coalition. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay. Now, most of our listeners are probably aware that the United States is hopefully trying to execute a coup d'etat against the elected leadership of Venezuela. But certainly there's a lot of propaganda out there that, you know, the head of Venezuela is really a dictator and not such a nice guy and not really committed to democracy. Can you just give us a quick overview of the situation in Venezuela?
Well, the present president of Venezuela is Nicolas Maduro. He was elected twice. Both times it was international observers. Jimmy Carter was one of the observers. And their election system has basically been understood to be one of the best in the world. An opposition candidate at any time can call for a recount. All parties are available for recount. It often is done publicly in some form so that anybody can observe and anybody can watch. And in the last election that Maduro was elected in, they had a higher percentage of their electorate voting than voted in our last national election. And we all know that in our last national election, the person who got the second highest vote total actually became president. That was Trump. But Maduro won by an overwhelming majority, close to 70%. It was something like 68%.
Didn't the opposition boycott or something, though?
Well, the opposition, there's several different figures in the opposition. Three of them ran against him. One of them, Guaido, started to run against him, but he was informed by the United States, we don't want you to run. And I think it was pretty clear why, because they thought he would lose, and that would not allow them to set up the situation that they've set up today. And that situation is that Juan Guaido declared himself president, clearly in consultation with the United States. Almost immediately, within hours, the United States recognized him as the legitimate president. Now, how the United States has any right to recognize anybody as the legitimate president of another country is a interesting question. And we always talked about on all the news media about Russian intervention into our elections and our internal affairs. None of that, of course, has been proven, but the question is, it is clearly above board the kind of intervention that we are doing into the internal affairs and to the election of Venezuela. Because we don't like the Venezuelan government, because it wanted to use its oil resources, which have been nationalized, which means the U.S. oil companies can't get their hands on those profits, because we don't like that nationalization and the fact that he's using his money for the underclass, for the poor, for the blacks in Venezuela. We have had economic sanctions against them. We have used our influence within the world banking system to disallow them to refinance loans or even to get loans. The money that we hold of theirs for sales of their oil, which is done through Citgo oil company, we have not given to the country, and we are saying now we're going to give it to this rump person that we recognize, this Guaido, who nobody ever voted for. And so we've withheld that money. It comes to billions of dollars. Our allies are withholding resources of Venezuela and their banks. Britain is withholding $1.3 billion. Without the economic sanctions, without the pressures on the banks, without the political attacks, Venezuela might be doing pretty well. But we never will know, because the United States, if it doesn't like a government because it doesn't go along with the agenda of Washington and Wall Street, will put economic sanctions on and will squeeze the government and try to build oppositions. And they squeeze the government and put economic sanctions, so they hope that the population will turn against the government, and then a more favorable person can come into power that will turn over the oil resources to the Wall Street bankers and to our oil industry. And I think that's the real story of what's going on in Venezuela.
What are some of the racial and colonial, rule issues that are at play in this situation?
Well, there's a large black population. It's always been an underclass, as it is here. And it's a mixed population, African Venezuelan, as well as the indigenous population mixed together in Venezuela. And they make up the majority of Venezuela. But there's also a European white population, and there's always been a divide between the two. And it's very interesting if you look at the different rallies that these two groups have. In the American media, you will never see a pro-Maduro rally. They'll only show the opposition rallies. But the pro-Maduro rallies, you can see them all over the internet, are largely people with dark skin. And the anti-Maduro rallies are largely people with white skin. And sometimes they even boast about their wealth. They come out in suits or women wearing high heels or something like that to show their status. And so this is an opposition which is primarily of the wealthy. And although they've had some demonstrations, and some have been large, and people are very discontent because the economic situation is terrible, and I think the bulk of that is caused by the United States and its economic sanctions, but because of that, there are there are some people that are discontent, just like the United States wanted to show. But all the opposition rallies have been in Caracas. And the pro-Maduro rallies have not only been in Caracas, larger rallies than the opposition in Caracas, but have been all over the country. And if you go to different sites, you can see the different cities where they've been holding the pro-Maduro rallies. So I think that's the situation, that in spite of this downturn, this terrible economic situation, also a lot caused by the decrease in the price of oil, which I think was done very purposefully to hurt Venezuela, Iran, and Russia, who have been enemies of the United States. Because of that, they have also had a difficult time economically.
Now, of course, it is the role of Congress to declare war, not the president. So I'm sort of curious, what are the Democrats doing with their control of the House of Representatives to oppose the coup? Or are they supporting it?
They're supporting it. I mean, there's a few that don't. Tulsi Gabbard, who has had some pretty good positions, one of the few in Congress that has been opposing some of the U.S. wars. She opposed the war in Syria. She herself is an Iraq veteran, and she's opposing the coup. But most of them either say nothing or support the administration's policies. So there is no real Democratic Party opposition to this, and that's why we have to be out in the streets on Saturday and into the future.
Well, could you describe what's going to take place? So it's going to be at noon at Wolf and Central Avenue. I guess that's outside Colony Center. You know, both, you know, how the logistics of the event, you know, exactly where, and people bring signs and stuff. And then also, what are the sort of the political demands of the event?
Well, the basic plans are hands off Venezuela, no coup, no sanctions, no war, because there's a real threat of war right now. There's this idea that they're going to bring across some aid from Colombia into Venezuela. Trump announced yesterday at a very bellicose speech he made in Florida that they've sent a plane full of aid down there. A plane full of aid means absolutely nothing. And the aid he has done is minuscule compared to the aid that is getting into the country from Russia and China, for instance. So there's a real threat of war because he's going to try to push this aid in probably on Saturday, the date of these demonstrations, because that's when they said they're going to bring it in, through a military-enforced corridor where there will be military that will try to force the aid into Venezuela. You might remember during the recent hurricanes, Venezuela offered to aid the United States. They offered to give us oil and generators to get electricity up in New Orleans and in Houston, and we said no. But now they don't like the fact, the U.S. doesn't like the fact that they are saying no to our aid because they understand it's not really aid, but it's a military operation. So anyway, the demonstration will take place. It will be a vigil and rally. There'll probably be a couple of speakers, but it'll be mostly spontaneous. People should bring signs. It will be at noon at Wolf Road and Central Avenue, where there's a big intersection, and we hope to be very visible there. And we are one of about 100 that are taking place around the United States and many, many others throughout the world that will be taking place on that day. And it could be a very dangerous time for Venezuela. There could be on that very day an attack. There's other actions that are being planned into the future. An important one will be on March 30th because NATO is coming to D.C. and there'll be a national rally in D.C. on the 30th. And people could find out about both of these rallies from a national perspective by going to the best place to go to is the UNAC site. And you can read about all of these and go find out the specific sites to go to. And that site is unacpeace.org, UNACPEACE.org.
Joe, we're about out of time. You mentioned unacpeace.org. If people want to find out about the realities of the struggle in Venezuela, 20 seconds, how can they best do that?
Well, one of the things UNAC site has is a blog, and there you can read a lot of information that's different from the corporate media information, because the corporate media is only covering one side, just like they did in every other war, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, wherever, the State Department.
Joe, we're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us here today. That concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith.
Yay!
Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or stop by one of our weekly meetings Monday night, 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.